Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour, bringing you a sound picture of the founding of our radio station 80 years on and shining the spotlight on the Lateran Pax. But first, I'd like to mark the feast of Our Lady of Lourdes, which falls each year on the 11th of February and coincides with the day we mark the World Day of the Sick. I'd like to do this by picking up on something Pope Benedict said February the 6th on the occasion of the customary Sunday Angelus prayer. "I exhort all healthcare workers," he remarked on this occasion, "to look at the sick person and see not only a fragile body, but above all a person who deserves solidarity and adequate and competent treatment." Well, to highlight this loving care for the sick and suffering, I'd like you to join someone who reflects on a very personal story involving his dearest and nearest, and the loving care they received on a visit to Lourdes. He's Monsignor Peter Fleetwood.
I rang my parents in Wales one evening to ask them if they would like to visit Our Lady's shrine in Lourdes. They were delighted and accepted straight away. The months passed by as normal, but just 10 days before we were due to go, the doctors in the hospital in Chester told my mother she had an inoperable tumour on her lung and would need treatment. Having grown up poor, one of the first things she worried about was whether I would lose any money if she was unable to go to Lourdes. Luckily, she was reassured when I said it didn't matter, but that anyway she was to make up her own mind and not be bullied by anyone into going or not going. Having grown up a strong Catholic, she decided Lourdes was the best place to be, so we went. Mum had a difficult trip, and some people criticised me for making her suffer the inconvenience and even pain of going to the airport and the indignity of being pushed around Lourdes in a wheelchair. Why bother putting her through all that inconvenience? Poor Dad was at his wit's end and very depressed about why all this was happening. Why bother if the life you have built together has to end like this? And they both hated the attention which naturally comes your way if you're in a wheelchair in Lourdes or pushing one. We are very private people. The change came the day before we went home. Mum was scared of going to the baths at the shrine. The woman from the Isle of Man who took her in told me later on in tears of laughter that Mum was afraid because she couldn't swim. Nobody had told her it was a small bath into which the helpers lower you carefully. She must have thought it was an Olympic-sized swimming pool. I stayed outside with Dad, who was unusually nervous and short-tempered. It was very difficult for him. Why was all this happening? He got an answer when Mum came out with a radiant face, saying, "I've done everything I wanted to do now. Will you take me for a coffee, Peter?" She was amazed by the kindness absolutely everyone showed her. And Dad said that the wait outside the baths and walking around Lourdes had made him realise he had been feeling far too sorry for himself. His eyes had been opened by other people's sufferings. Two little miracles. Mum died less than 3 weeks later. My dad's burden was made much lighter, and the people who had been so critical said how wonderful it was that Mum had had the chance to go to Lourdes. What about me? Well, the big miracle was that this couple who hardly ever went anywhere accepted the invitation so quickly. Most people think of priests and other professional Catholics as people of faith, but I can tell you that on this occasion I was the one who was doing most of the learning. In a way, without wanting to give the wrong impression, I can honestly say that the miracles of the 1850s became distant memories when one sees the recurring miracles at Lourdes today. When I invited Mum and Dad to come, I had to be chaplain to a group which brought with it plenty of work but lots of fun, and very moving moments with people I felt really pleased and privileged to meet. Many times in the course of my work, I'm tempted to say, why bother staying here? But my own frustrations paled into insignificance on that special pilgrimage. That has often happened to me on trips to Lourdes, and on visits to hospital or prison, or even to sick people in their homes. The people who wondered whether it was worth bothering to take Mum on a difficult journey to a shrine in a foreign country got their answer, and were gracious enough to admit it. There were also many people like me who went as Christians who often wonder why they should bother remaining in the church or believing in God or being good people. I think many of us got our answer too. I would recommend it.
And while our thanks there go to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood for sharing this moving story with us, I'd like to move on in the broadcast on a totally different note. February the 12th marks our radio station's 80th birthday. As you know, Vatican Radio was set up by Guglielmo Marconi at the request of Pius the 11th and entrusted by this Pope to the Jesuits, who still manage it to this day. But if you wish to have a sound picture of that very day in 1931, which includes the voice of Marconi, his daughter Elettra, and of course Pope Pius the 11th, stay tuned.
Tiny Vatican State, from a great radio station built by Marconi, the Pope, for the first time in 1900 years of Catholicism, has sent his voice throughout the world. With this broadcast, His Holiness celebrates the ninth anniversary of his coronation as Pope Pius XI.
Iar caro dei consilium succedimus in loco principis apostolorum,
that was the voice of Pius XI at the inauguration of Vatican City's radio station on February the 12th, 1931.
Primi in loco ipso, mira sane ope marconiana, uti frui possumus.
Ho l'altissimo onore di annunziare che fra pochi istanti il Sommo Pontefice Pio XI inaugurerà la stazione radio.
The words of Pius XI followed those of the father of radio, Guglielmo Marconi.
Le onde elettriche trasporteranno in tutto il mondo, attraverso gli spazi, la sua parola di pace.
While Pius XI spoke in Latin, the universal language of the Church, Marconi spoke in Italian. For the first time in history, the voice of a Roman pontiff is about to be carried through the airwaves for all people to hear, Marconi said.
La sua viva voce può essere percepita simultaneamente su tutta la superficie della terra.
My father made friends with the Pope, who was Pius XI. In front of my mother, he asked my father to build important radio station in the Vatican City. He accepted with enthusiasm.
And that was Princess Elettra, Marconi's daughter, was named after her father's invention. She recalled playing in the Vatican gardens while her father discussed electric waves with Pius XI. It was 1929, and the Lateran Pacts had given Vatican City the right to communicate directly with other states. That's why the Pope had entrusted Marconi with the task of setting up the Vatican's own radio station.
And the visits were very long because they were talking for hours together. And when I was 3-4 years old, I started going with my father and my mother to visit Pius XI. And I remember that I was very lively and they were talking, they were great friends, and they were very enjoying their conversation. And the Pope, Pius XI, was very sweet and understanding. He wanted me to be present, but he was very understanding because I was running about, because I was very lively. So I remember that, especially when we were coming out from the visit, the noble guards and the devoted people who are in the Vatican, they were complaining because they were hungry, and they were saying that we were stayed too long, but that was Pius XI who wanted to speak for a long time with my father. I remember very well this.
You say your father spoke to the Pope at length. They spoke about scientific matters?
The Pope was asking questions to my father and wanted explanations and inquiring which were his new plans of his new inventions. Being a scientist, Pius XI, he understood thoroughly what my father was saying. And there was really a great friendship. And one can see now also from the many photographs that I treasure.
It was through the Vatican garden, so familiar to Princess Elettra, that on a raw and windy evening, Pius XI went by car to inaugurate the new radio station of Vatican City. His first gesture was to bless the city and the world.
This is the Vatican radio station, of which the Pope's voice has been heard all over the world.
While in 1931 communications were slow by today's standards, news of a Roman pontiff's first historic blessing through the airwaves spread fast. The city and the world knelt to the Pope's message. In the city of Rome, loudspeakers had been put up in streets and squares, and crowds of people gathered to listen to the Pope's voice, reaching them through the airwaves for the first time. Right across the world, people listened, from Europe to the United States to Australia. In England, where radio already existed, the BBC had been founded in 1922, news spread even faster. British newspapers gave ample coverage to the event. The Universe even ran a competition by the title of How I Listened to the Pope's Voice. A year after the first papal broadcast on Vatican Radio, the BBC broadcast the first ever royal Christmas message.
Through one of the marvels of modern science, I am enabled this Christmas day to speak to all my peoples that Wallace should have...
His Majesty George V's voice reached out to his subjects throughout the empire.
I speak now from my home and from my heart to you all, to men and women so cut off by the snows, the desert, or the sea, that only voices out of the air can reach them. I wish a happy Christmas. God bless you.
The words of the King on his first Christmas broadcast were words of wonder at the epoch-making discovery of modern science. Only a few months later, the words of the Pope to Marconi on Vatican Radio were filled with that same wonder.
Quali agguati della scienza, ella sorprende, sorprenda il cammino di queste onde che nessuno vede, nessuno ode, nessuno sente.
The Pope spoke of being baffled as to how Marconi had managed to transform into sound mysterious electric waves.
There is nothing to see, to hear, to feel, to touch, the Pope said. So how could the human mind possibly see what our eyes don't see?
Yet, despite Pius XI's understanding of the power of radio, Marconi's invention had not immediately been understood.
At the beginning, he was 20 years old. Nobody believed in him, only his mother, Annie Jameson. And when he made the invention in Italy, they didn't believe him. He went to England, and at last they understood the importance of radio.
Princess Elettra recalled how ostracized her father had been at first.
In 1901, when he had in mind to make the first transmission across the Atlantic, all the scientists of the time were against him. They were saying that it would have been impossible because the world is round, and so it couldn't reach the other side of the Atlantic. Instead, he was sure that he would succeed, and he proved to the world that he was right.
In the tiny Vatican State, from a great radio station built by Marconi, the Pope, for the first time in 1900 years of Catholicism, has sent his voice throughout the world.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that sound picture from 80 years ago. What I'd like to do now is take you back 82 years and speak to you about a historical event which set the stage for establishing Vatican Radio. To do this, we join Professor of Religious Studies and History at the University of Virginia in the United States, Father Gerald Fogarty. I'd just like to set the scene. The year is 1870, right? And the place is Rome's Porta Pia, one of the gates of the city. The Italian troops enter Rome at the time of the unification of Italy. This brings about the fall of the Papal States and the loss of temporal power for the Pope. What did this entail for the Pope at the time, who was Blessed Pius the Ninth now, and consequently for the Catholic Church?
Well, it was a twofold thing. Number one, in 1872, the Italian Parliament did pass the Law of Guarantees, which gave certain rights to the Pope. But nevertheless, that was a unilateral decision by the Italian Parliament. Technically, they could repeal it. It was not bilateral, withstanding an international law. So it did mean the Pope became the prisoner of the Vatican. The second thing was there was always the danger, by not having any type of temporal power to guard the spiritual sovereignty of the Holy See, it meant there was always the danger of the popes being cut off from his correspondence with his bishops. So those were the two main effects during the period that's known as the Roman Question until 1929.
You mentioned the fact that the Pope was a prisoner in the Vatican, but it was of his own will that he was a prisoner in the Vatican. He didn't have to be there.
No, but that was one of the things that this way he was wrecking. He was refusing to recognize the sovereignty of the Italian government over the city of Rome. By remaining only in the Vatican Palace and the Vatican grounds, he therefore was making a statement. That's why he personally became the prisoner of the Vatican. You're right. It was his decision.
Am I right in saying that Pope Pius IX may no longer have been head of the sovereign state, but continued acting and speaking for the whole church through the Holy See in continuity with early Christian times? In that sense, nothing changed.
Yeah, nothing changed, because he still spoke as head of the church, as head of the Holy See, the Diocese of Rome. And when a diplomat is accredited to the Holy See, they are accredited to the Pope as the head of the church, not to the sovereignty of the state of Vatican City, and certainly not to the state of the Holy See, as some recent diplomat said. But it does mean that the Pope continued to address the whole world in his capacity as head of the church.
This situation with the Pope then as a voluntary prisoner in the Vatican stalled right from the papacy of Pius IX through to those of Leo XIII, Pius X, Benedict XV, and their pontificates cover 52 years, no?
And halfway through the pontificate of Pius XI. There were some efforts, for instance, at the Treaty of Versailles in 1919. There were some overtures. Arrangements were made by an American priest, Francis Kelly, with the Italian government, and there were some preliminary meetings that took place at that time, 1919. And in fact, when the Lateran treaties were signed 10 years later, there was an allusion made to the early work that was done by this priest and one Italian diplomat. But for the most part, there were no real overtures. There were two things that happened. One was, in the 1890s, you had these cardinals called the conciliationists, who were working for conciliation. And they were willing to accept what became the present boundaries of Vatican City State. But there were other cardinals opposed, and so were members of the Italian government at the time, of actual recognition of a temporal sovereignty to guard the spiritual sovereignty. I use those terms, Veronica, because people get confused sometimes. The purpose of this little tiny state of 103 acres, I think it is to protect the spiritual sovereignty and authority of the Pope. so that he is not subject to any the whims of any particular government. And if he is in any way persecuted, then there's a legal standing. But anyway, that's people get confused on that.
So then things changed in 1922 when, after 52 years, Pius XI became Pope. And as soon as he was elected, he made an unexpected gesture and stepped out onto the balcony towards the Italian state.
That's
which is
right.
Something that hadn't been happening for 52 years. So
that's
it was
right.
A momentous gesture. It was the first in a long line of decisive gestures, no?
His gesture, Urbi et Orbi, because this had not been done since the fall of Rome. And incidentally, Pius XII, when he was crowned, would pick up on this, because although some critics say that his coronation took place with greater pomp than anything in the previous 70 years, they are absolutely correct, because this was the first coronation of a pope after the end of the Roman question. It could be done with all the pomp, in other words. Now, they've played it down more since then, but nevertheless, this was a gesture on the part of the newly elected Pius XI, who had a diplomatic background. He had been nuncio to Poland and then became Archbishop of Milan, though by training, he was really a librarian.
When Pius XI became pope, it was at a particular time in history. Mussolini had marched on Rome in 1922.
Yes, the fascist government was taking over, and there were compromises being made. For instance, in 1926, the Partito Popolare was banned, but that had to do with a number of issues. It had to do not only with pressure from the fascists, but also pressure from some cardinals as well who were pro-fascists, and they saw the Partito Popolare under the priest Luigi Sturzo as inhibiting some type of settlement of the Roman question. Also, Pius XI demanded that Catholic action take place under the direction of the local bishops. And the Partito Popolare was an independent movement. It was a political party. So there were a number of things, compromises that the Pope himself made in preparation for what happened.
Well, what happened? It was the 11th of February, 1929.
Yeah. Finally signed the Lateran Treaty, the concordat between the two entities. The Lateran Treaty guaranteed the creation of the Vatican City State, the spiritual sovereignty of the Holy See, therefore. The Concordat regulated relationships between the church and the Italian government within Italy. And then finally there was an agreement, a third pact that was signed in regard to financial remuneration and so forth. So this definitively ended the Roman question, signed for the Holy See by Pietro Gasparri, then the Secretary of State, and signed for the Italian government by Benito Mussolini, the Prime Minister.
And they're called the Lateran Pacts because they took place in the Lateran.
That's right. The Lateran Basilica is the cathedral for the Bishop of Rome. And attached to it is the Lateran Palace, and that's where the negotiation and final signing took place.
What did this imply for the Catholic Church at a universal level?
The little plot of land was to guard the spiritual sovereignty of the Pope and his communications with the Church throughout the world. Way back in the 1860s, just as an aside, some of the great liberal leaders of France, like Comte Montalembert, argued that the Catholic Church could be free nowhere unless there was a Catholic state somewhere. So he supported temporal power at the time, and though he was seen as a great liberal. Yet this is a thing that people don't seem to realize. In order to guarantee the spiritual autonomy, authority, freedom of communication, and so forth, of the Pope, there had to be some type of Catholic state guarding that. So therefore they created Vatican City State. 1929. So that was the significance for worldwide Catholicism.
Pius XI had trouble in leaving the Vatican for a long time, didn't he?
Yeah, he finally would go to Castel Gandolfo. One time he went there early was in 1938 when Hitler was visiting Rome. So the Pope went out to his summer villa in May, normally doesn't go until late June or July, and in 1938 he made a point of getting out there early. But you're right, the papal villa of Castel Gandolfo, just a little bit south of Rome, that was part of the Lateran Treaty guarantee that would still belong to the Pope. Enjoy extraterritoriality. It was sort of like an embassy, but actually the territory eventually was actually slightly larger than that of Vatican City State. But he still hesitated to go out.
The Italian state offered a larger territory, no? It was turned down within the Leonine walls.
Yeah, they did. Basically, what is now Vatican City State is, I believe, the limits of the approach of the forces of the Kingdom of Italy in 1870. Italian generals stopped right there. Whereas you do have the wall that runs out to the Castel San Angelo, which is a passageway where the Pope could escape to the fortress in case, as he did in 1527. But there were several negotiations going on in regard to the extent of this Vatican territory. that the Vatican City was already closed in by these walls. Nevertheless, in the Lateran Treaty, they do say that Vatican City technically starts at the steps of the Basilica, because the square had been open for so many centuries by that point.
You mentioned Pius XI going to Castel Gandolfo when Hitler came to Rome. Was that to avoid Hitler, meeting Hitler?
Oh, very definitely. He ordered the Vatican museums closed. He said, well, it was sort of implied that if Hitler asked for an audience, he may get one, but it was doubtful. But just in case he did want one, the Pope took off for Castel Gandolfo, which meant it was going to be difficult for Hitler to go there. And then he met a number of newly married people, and he talked about what a disgrace it was over the eternal city where the cross of Christ is present to have this eruption of a cross, the swastika flying up from almost every public building. So, no, it was done very much on purpose. Remember, this was a year after Medrano de Zurga, which the Pope had signed, but it was drafted by five German bishops and Pacelli, mainly drafted by Faulhaber of Munich, and it was a condemnation of National Socialism. Relations were very strained between the Holy See, the Catholic Church in general, and Nazism at that time.
Well, by becoming an independent state, Vatican City had acquired the right to communicate directly with other states. That's why the Pope, the day after the signing of the Lateran Pacts, entrusted Marconi with the task of setting up our own radio station here.
For any American listeners, but it's interesting, when the Pope broadcast his first message...
12th of February, 1931.
Well, it was translated into English and broadcast by Monsignor Francis Thelman, who later became the Archbishop of New York. But that was negotiated, and that was one of the things that was made possible by the Lateran Treaty, was that there could be a wireless system. And 2 years later, Vatican Radio came into being.
One last question. In 1984, I think, the Concordat was revised, wasn't it?
Yes, and ratified by the Italian Parliament the next year, 1985. And one of the most dramatic changes is the original Concordat in Clause Article 1 said that Catholicism would be the religion of the state. And it was revised that it's no longer the religion of the state, but the religion of the majority of Italians. Now, this was a rather great breakthrough because it did recognize religious liberty, whereas religious liberty did not come about until the Second Vatican Council. And in the early part of the 20th century and certainly through the 19th century, Vatican officials regarded it as religious indifference. They looked at it through the eyes of the French Revolution, as the present Holy Father has so many times said, as opposed to what was happening in the Anglo-American world, but especially in the United States, where religious freedom meant freedom for religion and freedom for the church. So this was a rather dramatic change. Now, it still guaranteed that there would be religious instruction in the schools and so forth. And, of course, it also was an addition to the Concordat made by the Republic of Italy, as opposed to the original Concordat, which was between the Kingdom of Italy and the Holy See.
And warm thanks there to Father Gerald Fogarty, Professor of Religious Studies and History at the University of Virginia in the United States. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.